sense by private financial firms that won't process their payments and private internet companies that won't host their site any longer. It's an attempt to suppress these views, which never really works, rather than trying to address them or contain them or defeat them.
And President Trump's response to what took place and the progressive Jewish leaders in Pittsburgh saying, you are not welcome in Pittsburgh until you renounce white nationalism?
So, I mean, you know, President Trump posted a tweet this morning that I thought was so far over the line of what is responsible. I've been somebody who's been, so, I mean, the thing about CNN being the enemy of the people in the wake of this pipe bombing, like I said, I'm more cautious about blaming Trump for
Glenn, we have to leave it there, but we're going to do part two at democracynow.org. Pulitzer Prize winning journalist Glenn Greenwald.
KABU Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KABU in accordance with requirements of the Communication Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KABU Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. This month, our meeting of the KABU Board of Directors will be on Monday, October 29th, from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. at Site of Riot at 807 Northeast Coote Street in Portland.
The time is 5 p.m., and you're listening to KBOO, Portland 90.7 FM. Up next is the evening news. KABU programming is made possible by KABU listeners, members, and support from Grendel's Coffee House, located at East Burnside Street and 8th Avenue in Portland, offering organic coffee, sandwiches, and more for breakfast and lunch. Grendel's Coffee House is open daily until 6 p.m. More information on the Grendel's Facebook page and by phone at 503-595-9550. That's 503-595-9550.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KABU Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a horrific anti-Semitic massacre at a Pittsburgh synagogue over the weekend is prompting reactions across the country.
Youth rallied in Portland and another U.S. cities today in support of the lawsuit Giuliana versus the U.S., which was delayed by the U.S. Supreme Court.
And a group of black Portlanders say they were snubbed by Commissioner Chloe Udalie and members of her staff.
Good evening. This is the KABU Evening News for Monday, October 29th, 2018. I'm Ken Jones.
And I'm Teresa Mitchell. Today, the Oregon Federal District Court in Eugene was scheduled to begin trying the case Giuliana versus the United States, which seeks a declaration that the federal government violated the plaintiff's constitutional rights by causing dangerous carbon dioxide concentrations in the Earth's atmosphere. The plaintiffs are 21 young people, now between the ages of 11 and 22. The Trump administration is trying to have the case thrown out in contradiction of Oregon-based federal judge Ann Aiken's order. Recently, the Supreme Court issued a stay on the case, citing the cost of litigating it, and in response, young people have taken to the streets in cities across the country, including in Portland.
Thank you all so much for joining us today. My name is Annika Main. I'm a senior at Franklin High School. The speakers you see before you today are all youth. This rally was organized by youth with the support of adults who are proponents of student-led activism. We are not only supporting the 21 plaintiffs who should be in federal court today, we are here to speak up and denounce climate change and our government's lack of action against it. Once Giuliana v. U.S. gets into the courts, and it will, I know the change we see will be both immense legally and socially. The unique nature of youth-led activism provides for a greater level of energy and outreach that both shocks and excites the surprising number of adults who doubt the power of young voices. But all of you here today show that there is a strong belief in youth power and climate activism.
That was from a rally this morning at Terry Schrunk Plaza in downtown Portland in support of the federal constitutional rights case Giuliana versus the United States. The plaintiffs filed a brief in the case today in hopes of having the Chief Justice let it move forward by the end of the week. KBOO's Jenka Soderberg and Lena Kanan were on the scene and have this report.
So we're here with Catalina, one of the speakers from today's rally. And Catalina, can you tell us what led you to come out today to get involved in this action?
It's just a part of me. Like, part of me just wants people to, I don't know. It's just, it's super important, and people need to know about it.
Well, what do you think about the lawsuit that's going on to call for a stable climate for the future?
I think it's super good, like, for the 21 plaintiffs to, like, actually do that. And it's, like, really good that they're young, too. And, like, that ageism is a big thing, too, because people are like, oh, young people don't know how to do this. They're not fully developed. Like, their brain's not fully developed. And, like, they don't know how to understand things like that.
And what would be your message to the Trump administration that's trying to squash this lawsuit?
Why? I'm just like, just why? Why are you trying to do this? They're just trying to pass it by just because they care about money, and they think money's more important than life.
And can you tell us your age and if you're with an organization in your school?
I don't have an organization at my school, but I'm 13 years old and I go to Fabian School.
Great, thank you. Did you have anything? All right. Thank you, Catalina. We're at KBOO Community Radio. And could you introduce yourself and your organization, your age, and what brought you out here today?
I'm Solomon Duke from Franklin High School. I'm 17 and I work with Portland Youth Climate Council. I came out here to perform a speech about the importance of climate justice in the Portland Public Schools school curriculum.
And when you talk about climate justice, what are you referring to?
I'm referring to climate activism, but also referring to just knowledge about climate change, how to stop it, what we need to do to make sure this world is heading in the right direction.
How has climate change affected you personally?
It has affected me a lot less than it has affected a lot of other people, because I'm very privileged. But even me, like, we can see the forest fires every summer. As a runner, it affects my running, because it's really difficult to run when the air is covered in ash and smoke, and you're not supposed to breathe it, and it makes training much more difficult.
How do you think that the older generation has let down the youth that are coming up today?
For over 50 years, people have known this is a problem, and no one has taken any action to stop it. And that is how they've affected us.
And what would be your message today to the Trump administration that's trying to squash the lawsuit that's going on?
You can try to silence us, but young people especially are finally getting our voices out there. We're going to do what we can to fight Trump and let our voices be heard.
Thank you very much, Solomon, for speaking today. Do you want to talk to KBOO?
Sure.
Great. So introduce yourself. What's your name and your age and your school and why you're out here today?
Okay, so my name's Naomi and I'm 10. I go to Sunnyside Environmental School, where we talk a lot about climate change and the environment and social justice. And I'm out here to support the environment, basically, because I feel that I have seen the effect of climate change. Even though I'm just 10, this has probably been the hottest summer for the longest time in Portland, because, like, it used to be super rainy almost every day, but now it's late October, and it's barely raining. So, yeah.
So you're seeing the effects of climate change here in Oregon. And what do you think that the future should be like? What do you think that we should do to change things?
I think that what we need to do is we need to cut down on fracking. We need to stop fracking, like I said in my speech. And we need to stop using fossil fuels and natural gas, because even though it says it's natural and it does come from the earth, if we take it out, that shifts the layers of the earth and causes earthquakes. all of that is just really bad for the earth and all the people who live on it. Yeah.
Well, and what is your message for the Trump administration that's trying to squash the lawsuit?
Well, my message for them is that even if you deny it, you know it's real, and all you're doing is stabbing yourself in the back and your future and the future generations of America.
Thank you very much. Anything else you want to add for our listeners?
I just wanted to say that anybody can make a difference, and just because you're a kid or just because you haven't been involved in this stuff doesn't mean you can't be. Yeah.
Thank you so much, Amy, for speaking with us here on KBOO. This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO Community Radio.
In national news, a right-wing anti-Semitic shooter opened fire during a baby naming ceremony at a Pittsburgh synagogue on Saturday, killing 11 people and wounding 6 others. 4 police officers were among those injured. A 46-year-old white male Trump supporter was arrested at the scene and charged with the attack. Police say the gunman entered the building with an assault weapon and yelled, quote, "All Jews must die." The suspect owns an arsenal of legally acquired weapons. He recently posted on social media, quote, "Screw your optics, I'm going in," along with pictures of his guns. Trump responded to the shooting by calling for armed guards at places of worship. The attack Saturday follows another shooting last Wednesday in Kentucky in which a white male gunman went to a black church and tried to force his way in through locked doors. When he couldn't get in, he went to a nearby supermarket and began targeting black people to shoot. He ended up killing an older black man and woman before he was arrested. These shootings also come the same week as the so-called MAGA bomber, named after the Trump slogan, "Make America Great Again," who sent 14 pipe bombs to Democrats and the media before he was arrested in Florida.
In Pittsburgh yesterday, Jewish leaders blamed Trump for fomenting hate, saying that Trump is not welcome in Pittsburgh until he fully denounces white nationalism, stops targeting and endangering all minorities, and ceases his assault on immigrants and refugees. Faith-based communities and organizations across the country have expressed their anger, sadness, and solidarity with the Jewish community after the murders. One of those organizations in the Portland area is the Institute for Christian-Muslim Understanding. For 15 years, the Institute has provided opportunities for Christians and Muslims in the Portland area to meet and have conversations. They sent out a statement this morning reacting to the Tree of Life shooting, and one of the Institute's co-chairs, Nancy Haught, spoke to KBOO reporter Sam Bowman this afternoon.
So what was the conversation like around that?
Well, we were heartbroken to hear of this tragedy and felt like we wanted to go on the record to say that we condemn the massacre and also anti-Semitism and any kind of hatred against people based on race or ethnicity or religion. It's so contrary to the sort of community that we're striving to create, where men and women can appreciate people that we might think of as other but see them still as human beings. So we wanted to create a statement and to send it out to members of our community and to the one in Pittsburgh, so that was struck by this tragedy.
What sort of feedback have you gotten so far?
I've heard from local rabbis who appreciated hearing this kind of support. I think that it's one of those situations where people are scrambling to put things into words. So I expect we'll get more feedback as in the next couple of days, too.
The last couple years have probably provided a lot of stuff for something with the name the Institute for Christian-Muslim Understanding to discuss. How has the Institute reacted to that?
Well, we have had a lot of interest from people in the community who, since the election, are concerned about immigrants, Muslims, and people of other groups that seem to be cast as others, or that culture seems to be telling us to be afraid of them, so that we have created some opportunities, one right after the election, to just come and listen to a handful of speakers, and we filled a high school gymnasium with people who just kind of wanted to connect with each other and let each other know that they cared. Since then, we've had a screened a film, we've had panel discussions, some concerts, anything that we can do that to sort of bring out people who may not themselves know a Muslim, or a Muslim who may not know a Christian, and just creating opportunities for them to meet and talk to each other. I'm afraid that this is an issue that's not going away anytime soon, and we just need to keep creating these avenues for people to take this small but critical step of putting aside their own fear and reaching out and having a conversation.
If people listening to this right now would wanted to get involved, what would be the best way for them to do that?
Well, we do have a website, and people could go there. We are putting together some activities for after the first of the year for Christians and Muslims to gather around a speaker and a topic. So if anybody's interested in just learning about that, they could tell us on our website, and we'll get back to them when we have the details more organized.
Is there anything you'd like to add before we wrap up?
I just think that, you know, right now we all need to take some responsibility for this culture that we live in. We need to recognize in our own lives how we are vulnerable to people telling us to be afraid. We need to take a good hard look at that and be willing to set it aside and get to know each other, to not automatically suspect or condemn somebody just because they don't agree with us in some important way.
I have been speaking with Nancy Haught with the Institute for Christian-Muslim Understanding here in Portland. Nancy, thank you so much for talking with me today.
You're very welcome.
For KBOO Evening News in Portland, I'm Sam Bowman.
The day after the right-wing attack on a Pittsburgh synagogue, the Oregonian newspaper ran an editorial praising the leader of Patriot Prayer, the Vancouver, Washington-based right-wing extremist group with white supremacist ties. A number of groups have called for a boycott of the Oregonian's advertisers until the publication issues an apology and/or retraction. On social media sites, multiple local journalists and activists expressed outrage and shock that the Oregonian editorial staff would publish an article praising Patriot Prayer leader Joey Gibson. According to the Oregonian, Gibson is just misunderstood. He's really for free speech, love, and unity, and though not mentioned in the article, the extermination of immigrants, people of color, Muslims, and Jews. In defense of the Oregonian's decision to print the piece, editorial page editor Laura Gunderson writes, quote, "Increasingly, I hear from readers who are angry when they read opinions that differ from their own. An opinion page that readers universally agree with is neither advisable nor attainable," end quote. Multnomah County Chair Deborah Cafori counters, quote, "The Oregonian has lost their focus. Giving a voice to people who live only to stoke violence and hatred is unforgivable. To claim otherwise is not being balanced. It's being complicit." Here's a sampling of reader comments on the Oregonian website. In a letter to the editor, Christopher in Southeast Portland wrote, "The misunderstood Joey Gibson by Elizabeth Hovde is at best a very shallow and misguided view of Joey Gibson, Patriot Prayer, and human nature as a whole. At worst, this glowing propaganda puff piece is just that, a propaganda puff piece meant to put bunny ears on a hungry wolf. To say that we as people do not understand the power of words to incite extreme violence is patently false. Words have the ability to inflict the worst types of violence we have ever witnessed. Never forget the Holocaust started with a few words in a book written in a jail cell by a single man with a grudge. Words are just tools. Use them to build bombs or to build bridges," end quote. That was from a letter to the editor of the Oregonian, and from other comments on the article itself, here's one. "Mrs. Hovde should be deeply ashamed, publishing this garbage piece just days after we've seen radicals like Gibson murder innocents in a synagogue and send pipe bombs all over the country." Here's another. My father and many Americans fought fascism in World War II. They'd be spinning in their graves if they saw it's being supported here in America. And still another, quoting American writer James Baldwin, who said, "We can disagree and still love each other unless your disagreement is rooted in my oppression and denial of my humanity and right to exist." Well, let's close with one of the more concise comments on the article. Goes, "Excuse me, I just vomited after reading that. Speaking for myself, I only hope the commentary used Sunday's Oregonian to clean up the mess."
According to an email and video released by local activists last Monday afternoon, quote, "A group of black residents attended a scheduled meeting with Commissioner Udalli downtown in her office at City Hall. We were not well received by Commissioner Udalli's scheduler, Robin Mullins," end quote. The Emmanuel Displaced Persons Association, too, had hoped to address the disposition of a parcel of land historically gentrified by the Emmanuel Hospital Complex in North Portland, the Interstate Corridor Urban Renewal Area. The email continues saying that Udalli staff member Robin Mullins, quote, claimed she did not know why we black residents wanted to meet with Commissioner Udalli. When asked why she didn't know the subject matter for this scheduled meeting despite having been sent this information several times, Robin appeared very hostile, aggressive, and with a chip on her shoulder. She overtalked us, did not listen to, nor was she interested in anything we had to say, end quote. The email was accompanied by a video and audio clip apparently generated in Commissioner Udalli's office, recording the voice of Marshall Runkle, office manager for Udalli. Here is a portion of the conversation recorded between Runkle and activists seeking to meet Udalli.
I'll wait out here.
Okay,
I can be out here.
Is this how we're treated by elected officials? And tell you the truth, I can't remember.
I feel like I got two fair questions. She made a proclamation that this is a fragrance-free building. Where is it posted that this is a fragrance-free building, and what does that even mean?
I don't know.
Okay. And my other seemingly fair question is, if it's a fragrance-free building, i.e. her allergies cause her to not be able to be in this room with us right now, I'm trying to figure out why exactly there was an aversion to my request to remove the Ouija board off of the corner of the table where we're having a meeting. And I feel like the commissioner could better field that question, but I wouldn't even mind if you just asked her and just relayed that answer back, because I understand she can't come back in the room because of her allergies, and this is a fragrance-free building.
Okay.
And, oh, sorry, at that point when I was told, oh, so you're coming into my office to tell me that you have a problem with something I have sitting on my table. Is that?
That's what she said.
Yeah, that's what
that's
I thought.
How she said it.
And it confused me because, like I said, my understanding is this is a public space.
Public
and it's for the public, actually. So that's a really confusing take on. I have never in my life.
So wait a second. Marshall, I'm remembering that I did receive an email stating that I believe it was you would need to. When the initial conversation started, that you would sort of look at the issue we want to talk about. It was either you or James, I can't remember. Do the requisite work, the prerequisite work, in preparation for this meeting. So it doesn't even sound like that happened. Is Commissioner Udalli just trying to skirt the conversation about the Interstate Corridor Urban Renewal Area? Because I have a thread of emails that show, send us the topic so we can do the requisite research and all of that. But then you're saying that they just found out about it this morning.
Well, there's clearly a communication breakdown on our side. Like, mm-hmm. I saw your message, so it's not like I'm satisfied that you got the information to us that we needed to get to, and it's our fault for not preparing adequately.
So what is Commissioner Udalli's reason then for not meeting with us? for not meeting with a group of black citizens who want to talk to her about an issue that is near to us, that impacts Portland's black community. What is her reason for not meeting with us right now after having this meeting scheduled and on her calendar for several weeks now?
To clarify, the activists say Udalia had abruptly left without engaging or starting a meeting, citing fragrances and her right to a Ouija board at a public space. Chloe Udalia's office responded to a KBOO query this afternoon, saying they were unable to comment in time for the KBOO news deadline.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth interview with Nick T. Devlin, writer, composer, and producer of the Halloween musical Midnight Rose, which airs tonight on KBOO at 11 p.m. At 6 o'clock tonight, it's Labor Radio. At 6:30, Prison Pipeline. Then at 7, Hard Knock Radio with Davey D. Tonight's weather calls for continuing drizzle and a low of 47 degrees. Tomorrow it will clear somewhat and the high will be 57. Today in history, in 1966, the National Organization for Women was founded. The quote of the day is from Mother Jones, who said, "I am not afraid of the pen or the scaffold or the sword. I will tell the truth wherever I please."
You're listening to KBOO Portland, and now we'll hear a roundup of stories from the Public News Service, a daily newswire in the public interest with bureaus in 36 states, including Oregon.
The Public News Service daily newscast for Monday, October the 29th, 2018. I'm Mike Clifford. A first court appearance expected today for the Pittsburgh synagogue shooter. Also on the Monday rundown, health care and clean air, key issues in the fast-approaching midterm elections, plus the cost of living increase, a win, but not a windfall for Social Security recipients. Now our top story, 46-year-old Pittsburgh synagogue shooting suspect Robert Bauer is expected to have his first court hearing today. The Washington Post reports he faces at least 23 state charges, including homicide, attempted homicide, and aggravated assault against police officers. He faces an additional 29 federal charges, accusing him of civil rights and hate crimes. The Post reports early investigative details suggest that the virulent anti-Semite needed only a few minutes, three pistols, and an AR-15 semi-automatic rifle to carry out the deadliest attack on Jews in U.S. history, killing 11 people inside the Pittsburgh synagogue. The suspect reportedly told a SWAT officer, "They're committing genocide to my people. I just want to kill Jews." And health care appears to be a hot-button issue for voters in Ohio and across the nation.
According to polling from the Kaiser Family Foundation, 75% of Americans say it's very important the Affordable Care Act provision protecting individuals with pre-existing conditions remains law. Jeanetta King with Think Tank Innovation Ohio explains that without those protections, a trip to the doctor's office or emergency room is very costly for people with pre-existing conditions.
Almost 5 million people have pre-existing conditions that before the Affordable Care Act found themselves really struggling to afford health care. And now they are very concerned that those protections for their pre-existing conditions might get taken away.
An estimated 27% of Americans ages 18 to 64 have some kind of pre-existing health condition, such as asthma, diabetes, or heart disease. Mary Sherman reporting.
Kaiser polling shows Americans across the political spectrum support pre-existing condition protections. That includes 86% of Democrats, 75% of Independents, and 58% of Republicans. Corporations that have violated the Clean Air Act are vastly outspending environmental groups and political contributions in Missouri. Eric Tingenoff explains this is raising questions about their outsized influence on the legislature.
The Missouri chapter of the Sierra Club analyzed three companies with documented violations of the Clean Air Act and found they have contributed more than $1.2 million to state officials, parties, or PACs since 2015. In comparison, four Missouri environmental groups have contributed $9,400 over that period, 136 times less. Missouri Sierra Club Director John Hickey says that's why the state needs Amendment 1, which aims to reduce the role money plays in state government.
136 times is enormous, and that explains one of the reasons why these corporate polluters are able to evade the law or rewrite the law so that they do not have to follow the Clean Air Act and they can pollute the air that we all have to depend on.
Amendment 1, known as Clean Missouri, would substantially limit lobbyist gifts to state lawmakers and lower campaign donation limits for legislative candidates. The measure also would create a nonpartisan demographer position to draw legislative maps. Opponents say they believe maps still won't be fairly drawn under this amendment.
And a new research center at Utah State University is continuing to draw criticism over its connection to politically influential billionaires Charles and David Koch. Catherine Davis Young has our report.
The Koch brothers last year pledged $25 million to the university to establish the Center for Growth and Opportunity. A new report from the nonprofit Center for Biological Diversity and the group known as UnKoch My Campus calls into question the center's goals and says it lacks university oversight. Samantha Parsons, one of the report's authors, feels the public university is being used to push the Koch's corporate interests.
Academia's independence is what provides academia with the prestige and reputation in terms of being able to trust the education and the research that's coming out of an academic institution.
Koch Industries, one of the largest private companies in the U.S., has financial interests in oil and gas and stands to gain if more public land in the West is opened to development. The report says the majority of new hires at the Center for Growth and Opportunity came from a Koch-backed advocacy group called Strata Policy, which has worked against environmental and public lands protections, including advocating against the establishment of Bears Ears National Monument.
And finally, Ross Brown tells us the cost of living increase, or COLA, that takes effect for people on Social Security next year will be the most generous in years, but she adds it's still mostly grocery money and not a trip to the beach.
The average South Dakota recipient collects about $1,300 a month from Social Security, which means with the increase, the typical senior is now looking at about a $40 monthly boost, or $468 per year. Mary Johnson with the Senior Citizens League says this is the largest COLA increase since 2012.
And there have been 3 years when there was no cost of living adjustment at all. And in 2017, it was only 0.3% or almost zero.
Johnson says people who receive less than $600 in Social Security income won't see any net increase in their benefit.
South Dakota seniors are at least fortunate to be one of the 37 states that doesn't impose state income taxes on Social Security earnings. I'm Mike Clifford. Thanks for starting your week, Newsin' & Cruisin', with Public News Service. We are member and listener supported, and we're online at publicnewsservice.org.
Texas residents are complaining that they've observed their votes being changed in front of their eyes by electronic voting machines. However, election officials shifted the blame to voters, saying they should be more careful in using the hard InterCivic eSlate voting machines. Texas election officials were cited in the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, saying voters casting straight party tickets simply need to slow down and be careful. Texas voters say that when they vote a straight party ticket on the machines, the vote for senator, which is being contested between Republican Ted Cruz and Democrat Beto O'Rourke, switches to a vote for the Republican Ted Cruz. Texas Secretary of State Rolando Pablos is having none of it. He was quoted saying, quote, "It's important for all voters using the Hart InterCivic eSlate to understand that the voting machines are not malfunctioning, nor are they arbitrarily switching the choices of voters who cast a straight party ballot." Moreover, he continued, the Secretary of State's office has observed a disturbing trend where misinformation is being spread regarding the scale and the impact of these reported instances. This has the potential consequence of raising unnecessary alarm about the integrity of Texas voting systems and discouraging eligible Texas voters from casting their ballots, end quote. The Hart eSlate machines are used in 81 Texas counties where early voting runs through Friday.
In the Gaza Strip this weekend, Israeli forces targeted and killed three teenage children. According to local sources, the children were placing a trap for birds in a field near the border when Israeli soldiers fired an artillery shell at the children, blowing them to pieces. This comes after a weekend of shelling and bombing by Israeli forces, in which more than 80 bombs were dropped on the tiny and crowded Gaza Strip, following a ceasefire declaration by Hamas on Friday.
Jair Bolsonaro became president of Brazil by a 10-point margin last night, becoming the leader of the world's fifth largest country and the most extreme right-wing leader among the democracies of the world. Bolsonaro is anti-abortion, pro-gun rights, and a former member and strong proponent of Brazil's brutal military dictatorship that ended in 1985. He also made statements in favor of exiling his political enemies and came out strongly against immigration, affirmative action, same-sex marriage, and LGBTQ rights across the board. Journalist Glenn Greenwald of The Intercept, who lives in Rio de Janeiro with his husband, recorded an analysis of what Bolsonaro's election means for Brazilians and the world. We have part of that analysis here.
So the Western media has long talked about Bolsonaro in the only way that they could understand him, which is, quote, Brazil's Trump or the Trump of the tropics. And I think now, for many reasons, even the Western media has come to realize how woefully inadequate, in fact, wildly misleading that is. He really isn't comparable to Trump. He's far more extreme and poses a far more serious danger to basic human rights and democracy. And that's true for three reasons. The first of which is that Bolsonaro was actually part of a military dictatorship when he served in the military that only ended in 1985 and explicitly wants to reimpose it. He talks about the military dictatorship as being a far superior form of government to the democracy under which Brazil has lived for the past 30 years. He has said things like he believes that only a civil war can solve Brazil's problems in which 30,000 people are killed and that even if innocents die, that's okay since innocents die in war. He talks about how torture was justified and warranted when used against domestic dissidents. And he, in general, simply talks about a cleansing, as he called it in the last speech that he gave before the vote, that's needed, unlike, he said, anything seen in Brazilian history, where the left of the country will be eliminated, either because they'll be killed, imprisoned, or forced to leave the country. Beyond that, Brazil's institutions democratically are far more fragile and there are far fewer checks than exist in Western Europe or in the United States because Brazil is such a young democracy. Its institutions have been decimated by a convergence of scandals. So even if you wanted to believe that there are other figures similar in thinking or ideology to Bolsonaro, the fact that he's in Brazil and not much older and more established democracies means the limits that might be imposed on him are far fewer and far weaker. And then the final point that I think has gone most overlooked is that even though he has tried to link himself to other new right or far right modern leaders like Donald Trump or Nigel Farage or Marine Le Pen, the reality is much different. Even Marine Le Pen said that she found most of his statements and many of his planks to be horrendous and offensive. And that's because Bolsonaro is really not part of the modern alt-right movement. He really comes from the far-right extremist movement that preceded it from the 60s and 70s, one that was devoted not to the dangers of what it considers to be posed by migration of Muslims or Africans, but instead by what he perceives to be an existential war against communism, including communists in the country. And if you look at the atrocities that have been carried out in the 20th century after Stalin and Mao, far more atrocities were committed in the name of fighting against communism than communism itself, whether it be Indonesia or the Philippines or the regimes in Latin America that the US and the UK supported, including here in Brazil, as well as in Chile, Argentina, and elsewhere. That's his mentality and mindset.
And now it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Native American news issues and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Montana ACLU has filed a lawsuit against four federal agencies in conjunction with the Keystone XL pipeline project. It alleges violations of the Freedom of Information Act. ACLU claims it was stonewalled by the Departments of Justice, Interior, Defense, and Homeland Security after asking about training of local and state law enforcement agencies to counteract protests. Victoria Wicks reports.
Alex Raitt says ACLU also submitted right-to-know requests to local and state law enforcement agencies, and based on those responses, determined that federal coordination and training has been ongoing for some time. He says this federal involvement is likely a reaction to the protests at Standing Rock during the construction of the Dakota Access Pipeline. Raitt says ACLU wants information to pass along so that people planning to exercise their First Amendment right to protest will know what kind of response to expect.
I think that in the wake of Ferguson and in the wake of Standing Rock, there's a great concern among protesters and indigenous protesters in particular that they're going to see a heavy militarized response by law enforcement, that they're going to see monitoring of their social media accounts.
The legal director says it appears that law enforcement will focus on squelching protests rather than responding to a potential spike in crime when construction workers arrive. Although the pipeline doesn't cross current boundaries of reservations, it comes close to four of them in South Dakota. Raitt says if non-Indian workers commit crimes on reservation land, tribal police won't be able to arrest them. According to TransCanada's timelines filed with courts, clearing of land for man camps and pipe yards has begun, and construction on the pipeline is expected to begin in spring. For National Native News, I'm Victoria Wicks in Rapid City, South Dakota.
The 2013 Violence Against Women Act is due for a reauthorization by Congress so it can be funded to continue services for shelter programs and coalitions nationwide, especially on reservations. But as Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards reports, a recent bill that would have done so only received Democratic votes and is now stalled.
Republicans stepped in at the last minute to keep the act funded by including it in an appropriations bill called the Continuing Resolution, or CR. Caroline Laporte is a policy advisor for the National Indigenous Women's Resource Center. She says the CR is not a permanent fix, though, since it will lapse in early December. She says delaying until after the midterm election feels like a political maneuver.
I think violence against women should be a bipartisan issue, right? It definitely shouldn't be something that we draw party lines on.
The 2013 Violence Against Women Act gave tribes more authority to prosecute domestic violence crimes, including those by non-natives. But Laporte says there are several gaps that continue to limit tribal authority. She says the Democratic bill would allow tribal courts to prosecute violence against children, as well as attacks by strangers. And it would be good to see that bill move forward after the election.
There's a lot of momentum right now, just with everything that's going on in the Me Too movement and, you know, and with women sort of mobilizing on these issues. And so I think if people can just sort of continue to do that, you know, that we can have a reauthorization that will have meaningful provisions for Native women.
Laporte says it's critical to reauthorize the act since one in four Native women experiences sexual violence in her lifetime, twice as likely as women in any other ethnic group. For National Native News, I'm Melody Edwards in Laramie.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, October 29th, 2018. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. You can call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Layla Kanan, Janka Soderberg, Ken Jones, and Teresa Mitchell, and our engineer is Danielle Parks. The interim directors of Evening News and Public Affairs are Sam Bowman and Teresa Mitchell. A podcast and transcript of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Ken Jones.
Coming up Tuesday morning on KBOO at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman, Juan Gonzalez, and Nermaine Sheikh. At 8, the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show covers politics, history, and the state of the zeitgeist with a liberal dose of listener calls. At 9, Alternative Radio socialist organizer Haley Pessin speaks on the radical legacy of Fannie Lou Hamer. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, Stage and Studio talks with literary and performing artists from around the Northwest. At 11:30, Art Focus presents a piece of the Afrofuturist movement with a look at the upcoming performance of the Sun Ra Orchestra at the Portland Art Museum. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by members' support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate. Good night, Ken.
Good night, Teresa. Good night, Danielle.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Our in-depth guest today is Portland-based composer, writer, director, and producer Nick T. Devlin. Nick has four musicals to his credit, Princess of the Night, Noelle, Noelle, Alice Trippin' Sixes, and Noelle, A Celebration of Christmas. And he's written, scored, directed, and produced a new work, Midnight Rose, a dark, gothic Halloween musical, which premieres on KBOO, appropriately enough, 2 days before Halloween, tonight at 11 p.m. Nick describes Midnight Rose as a tale of royal dreams, nefarious power, and evil most foul. And he's here with us in the KBOO studios to tell us more about it. Nick T. Devlin, thanks for coming into KBOO.
Thanks for having me. I really love KBOO. It's a great radio station.
Now, Nick, your first musical, Princess of the Night, was first performed on stage at Portland's Interstate Firehouse Theater. That was back in 2013.
Right.
Can you tell us a little bit about that production and what the learning curve was like? Before the interview, you mentioned it, there was some disastrous events there.
Yeah, it did not go well. I had never produced a musical before, and so I just jumped in with both feet. I had written all this beautiful music. I had the cast, everyone was ready to go, and it just fell apart. And
what do you mean fell apart? People forgot lines?
Didn't know where to stand, songs got left out. It was just a total disaster from
just
one end to the other.
One performance only?
It was two performances. Uh-huh. The second one was better, but not by much. And I'm not very proud of that one. It was bad.
So there was quite a learning curve. I guess that answers my question.
Yes, and I did learn. The next one was much better. In fact, each one I correct mistakes, and they just improve and improve. And this one should be quite well done.
So before we get into the new one, and then even some of the ones before that first disastrous one and the more successful ones now, what attracts you to musical theater, and which composers and shows are inspirations and influences on your own work?
Well, I was a preacher, and I kept having my piano players would quit, and this happens a lot in all churches. They get burned out. And so I was one day said, you know what, I need to learn piano. And that was in the year 2010, and I started taking lessons, and I actually wrote my first musical after 3 years of lessons. And I've only had 5 years.
That's incredible. A lot of the people I know who play piano started as kids. They were forced into it by their parents.
Right. I wish I had been. However, I started quite late in life, and I've done quite well with it.
You must have an innate talent, I would think, for music.
I'm not a very good piano player, but I'm a very good composer. So I'm mediocre when I play, but I can compose like nobody's business.
Do you have some influences there then, famous composers, maybe for the musical theater?
Well, obviously the well-known ones, Rodgers and Hammerstein. You know, I try to listen to musicals and try to pick them apart, how they do things, how they're running, how the storyline goes. One of my favorites is the one with Johnny Depp. I'm sorry.
Oh, Sweeney Todd.
Thank you.
Stephen Sondheim, yes, one of mine also.
One of my favorite musicals is Sweeney Todd.
Uh-huh.
And I love how the storyline goes and how the music all meshes, and it just works beautifully. And I try to not copy, of course, but try to use that influence to teach me how to do my musicals.
Now let's talk about going back to the more successful musicals. Your second one was Noel, Noel, and that actually debuted here on KABU on Christmas Eve 2014. Was that much of a switch going from live theater to a radio production? I assume you no longer needed a choreographer.
I didn't need a choreographer. It was much easier. And it was cheaper. You don't need props. You don't need costumes. You don't need set. And so it was a much cheaper production as far as cost. However, it went really well. I had learned my lesson from the first musical and the disasters there, and I did not repeat any of those mistakes in the second one. And it's probably on file here. It's a beautiful musical.
Was that pre-recorded then or performed live on
pre-recorded.
The air? Okay, so, mm-hmm. So there you can actually correct any disasters before
right.
before the listeners find out.
Right.
Now, your newest work, which we'll hear later tonight, the radio musical Midnight Rose, it airs at 11 o'clock tonight on KABU. It's described as a tale of royal dreams, nefarious power, and evil most foul. Can you tell us a little bit more about the story of Midnight Rose?
I can. And I described it that way because I wanted it to sound over the top. And it is over the top. This is a musical about a young girl named Sarah Hain. She longs to be royalty. Her dad raised her as if she was a princess. On her 16th birthday, her dad gives her a tiara. And she decides at that point that she really is royalty, so much so that she even starts speaking with a British accent. Her friends try to tell her that she's not a princess, but she will not listen. And in the end, she does become royal. She becomes the princess of the night, the Midnight Rose. And as evidence of her royalty, wherever she goes at night, the roses bloom all around her. And she also commands the shadows of the night to do her bidding. And so she does become a princess and royalty.
Now, where's the evil most foul come in?
Well, she also dispatches her enemies with Belladonna. And there is a song about Belladonna that's in the show that she sings. And it's a pretty song, gorgeous, but it's about evil. So...
Now, Nick, what's the process been like for you? And it probably changes from musical to musical, but as writer, composer, director, producer, and editor, too, of the radio versions, do you start with the book for the show or the songs?
Usually I start with an idea. I may not have the whole story, but I have an inkling of where the story's going, and I start writing music to fit that story. So I start with the music, and it helps...
It helps the story along. Well, you mentioned Sweeney Todd, which is a perfect blending of story and music, so
right.
It makes sense.
I don't always have the whole story, but the music helps guide me to where I'm going.
So it's kind of organic process. You can't really separate one or the other.
Right.
And then do you cast before everything's done, or you wait till the music and the book is done?
I wait till the entire thing is finished. And then I hold casting sessions. But I also like to work with the same actors over and over. And quite often, these actors have been with me through every single musical. In fact, a couple of them were in the first one that was a disaster. But they realize that I've recognized the mistakes, and they've stuck with me, and they're still in all my productions.
And what about the recording then, say for the radio? So you record that at Open Signal.
I recorded this one at Open Signal. In the past, I've recorded them here at KABU, but that didn't work out this time. Instead, we recorded in a sound booth at Open Signal TV station.
Over a period of time with different actors in the room at different times, so you're putting that all together in the editing right
Correct.
Now.
Correct, right. It's a big job.
Now, we mentioned Midnight Rose is your fifth musical. You've grown quite a bit as a composer and a writer. You've also scored, Nick, 9 films,
right.
including a short film made by KABU's David Kesters, The Impossible Dream, which I looked at before we came in here today. It was shown at the Minnesota Film Festival, MN Kino, in July 2016. Can you tell us a little bit more about that short film and how it came to be, how David came to make it, but how you came to be to enter in as the composer and doing the score?
Well, the film festival likes to pair a filmmaker with a composer, and David and I knew each other, and he knew I composed music, and he asked me to be his partner in that. And he created the film, and it's about a guy that eats some cat food, and there's something wrong with the cat food. It sends him on some kind of a trip. And so he gave me this, and I had like 4 months to write the music, and it was interesting. I've never scored a film before that, and I found it quite enjoyable, but also a lot of work, because timing is important in
a yes,
film.
It has to be synchronized perfectly.
Right, and that was fun, difficult, but it was fun.
Are you watching the film then as you're composing the work? And is there some system to kind of sync up the video with the audio while you're actually doing the composing?
I keep a lot of notes.
Uh-huh.
This happens at this second, this happens at that, and I try to make my music hit those spots, and I did really well on my first film. It's in sync pretty well.
And that same film festival, the very next year, you scored another movie, I think also with cats, because it's called a Mew Hope, M-E-W?
Yes.
Instead of New.
Right. And it was kind of a Star Wars take on cats in space having battles. And
is this David also, David Kester?
Yes, it is. It is a great film.
He loves cats.
Huh? Yeah. Well, you know, so do I.
Yeah, me too.
I have one of my own. But it was a lot of fun. It was a great film, and I was very happy to be involved in the project and to compose the music for it.
Now, what are the challenges in scoring a film as opposed to writing a musical? We mentioned the audio, of course, has to be synced up perfectly with the video. That's one.
Right. And it also has to fit the mood of the film, but also not take over the film. The music should kind of almost be invisible and yet set the mood. You don't want people going, oh, the music is overpowering what's happening on the screen. So you've got to find a balance in there of music and show, and have the music just guide the show along, not take it over.
Do you have any plans for the next musical?
Can
you give us a preview?
With 2019, uh-huh, I have 6 music videos I'm going to do.
Wow.
And in 2020, I have an Easter musical that I'm going to try to perform on stage. It has 27 new songs that I've written for Easter, and some of it is very beautiful music. I'm really looking forward to that, but that's a huge project.
You seem to specialize in holidays. You did Christmas musicals, Halloween. I think you did a Valentine's Day one too, right?
Well,
and now Easter.
Well, to do a show, you got to have some kind of a hook, something
right
that interests me. And holidays are easy, you know. And in fact, the music videos that I'm going to do 2019, they're all on holidays. And I just finished writing the Halloween one,
uh-huh,
for 2019. And it's a fun song, and it's going to be a blast.
Well, Nick, how can our listeners find out more about your work, all your work, not just the musicals, but the film scores, and tune into the premiere of Midnight Rose? And if they can't stay up to 11, maybe catch it at a later date?
Well, I know that Open Signal plans to broadcast it as well. They're going to take video that was shot behind the scenes. There's not really a show to watch. It's meant more for you to listen to while you're handing out Halloween candy, not so much sit down and watch. So I'm not sure exactly what time that's going to be shown, mm-hmm, but I would assume, knowing Open Signal, that it will be on Halloween night.
Do you have a webpage? Well, I know you have Facebook and Twitter, so you won't be sending that information out if people
I don't have a webpage at the moment.
Uh-huh.
But I mean
through Facebook and Twitter, will there be ways people can follow you and find out?
Oh, yes. On Facebook, Nick T. Devlin. And I'm on Twitter, but I really don't tweet.
I noticed that when I researched the
I'm mostly
the
on there because a lot of musicians that I like tweet all the time, and so I'm always seeing what they're putting out. And they put their compositions out there, and I want to hear them.
Well, social media seems to be important, but it's also the bane of a lot of creative artists.
Right.
It's not our favorite part. We've been talking with Nick T. Devlin, Portland-based composer, writer, director, and producer, about his Halloween musical Midnight Rose, which you can hear on KBOO tonight, Monday, October 29th at 11 o'clock. I want to play Nick out with a title tune from the show Midnight Rose, sung by Dylan Graves. Nick, can you set it up a little bit for the listeners, and then we'll give them a taste?
Knight is in love with Sarah, but Sarah is oblivious. She does not care. She's in love with the night. And so Jack's trying to get her attention by singing this song, Midnight Rose, while he's picking roses and giving to her, but she's ignoring the entire song.
But it's still a beautiful song, and yes, we'll play it for you now. Midnight Rose. Thanks, Nick.
Thank you.
Midnight Rose is a nighttime flower that blooms in the dark and gloom, and its scent is intoxicating to all who come near. It's a rose that is far more beautiful than every other rose or flower that blooms underneath starry skies. Midnight Rose is my nighttime princess, and where she goes, all the roses bloom underneath the moon. Midnight Rose is a princess of the night, underneath the stars, beauty in the midnight roses.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Vote Together Portland. March to the ballot box on Thursday, November 1st from 6 to 8 p.m. at Dig a Pony in Portland. Join the Bus Project for a trip to the ballot box and a party to celebrate voting. Vote Together will meet at Dig a Pony at 6 p.m., then march up to the ballot box for red carpet voting, music, and more. Ballots are due on November 6th. Again, that's Vote Together Portland. March to the ballot box on Thursday, November 1st from 6 to 8 p.m. at Dig a Pony, 736 Southeast Grand Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
The time is 6.01 p.m. You are listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next is Labor Radio.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone.